obesity, mental health, alcohol intake, and smoking habits. I'll put my hand up to two of those. I'll let you guess. No, three of those, actually. No. Oh, dear. Anyway, yes. The Southwark Pensioners Centre has been going for 30 years, as you know, and we're just based in Camberwell Green. It's good to see so many of our members here today. If any of you would like to join who are not members, then you are certainly welcome to do so. It's only £12 a year. That's £1 a month, which isn't bad, is it, when you think about it? Hey, five bob a week. My goodness gracious me. Anyway, so you're always welcome to join us in Camberwell. We have lots of different events, from line dancing to singing. I would like to say a big thank you to the recorder group who played us in today. I thought they were tremendous. We've got the choir as well later on. So there's loads of things that we do there. We would like in the near future maybe to find bigger and better premises. And that's a quest that we are on at the moment, because where we are, it's not really suitable for maybe people with disabilities. What's the other thing I was going to say? That's about it, really. So welcome, welcome. If anyone is interested in becoming a trustee of the Southwark Pensioners Centre, please have a word with me later on. We would enjoy people who come from different backgrounds, with different skills and different ideas, which makes up for a good board of trustees. So if you're interested, you know where to talk to. So without further ado, I'm going to invite Dora to come up. You know Dora, don't you? Yes. Good. Hello, Dora. Good. Well done.
Thank you very much.
And I'll leave you to it. Thank you, Dora.
Thank you, Charlie. Where have I heard that before? Good afternoon, everybody. It's really great to be here this afternoon and great to see so many familiar faces from the time when I was chair of the Pensioners Centre. I just want to say thank you to all of you for keeping faith and keeping us on as a member of the Southwark Pensioners Centre. Thank you to Kathy and to Charlie and all the staff for actually keeping the organisation going. And thank you to you guys as well for actually supporting it. Thank you very much. Now, before I introduce the main part of this afternoon's programme, I just want to check that you've all got a programme. Yes? Okay. And you've all got a pledge card. Because after today's talk, I'm sure that you'll have lots of things here that you're going to pledge to do differently that will actually hopefully improve your life. And like Charlie, I can own up to two things, two out of the five things. How many can you own up to? Say, oh, this person, that person doesn't need any introduction. Well, Professor Moxham doesn't really need any introduction at all. He's a Camberwellian, lives in Camberwell, and you can see from your programme, it's just part of his, can I call it CV? Part of the things he's achieved, a lot more besides, and perhaps you can take the opportunity during your questions to ask about the other fabulous things that he has done. Just finally, I want to just acknowledge Sally. Sally, thank you very much for being here with your family and friends. Thank you to all of you for making the time to be here this afternoon. So, without further ado, I just want to introduce up to the stage our friend. He's a friend of the Pensioners Centre. He's spoken to us before on other occasions. You know him. We know him. Professor Moxham, please come to the stage.
Lovely.
God bless you.
Lovely.
Bless you. Take care. Good luck.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Well, I might need a bit of water, mightn't I, Isaac? Well, the first thing to say is thank you all very much for being here. And thank Southwark Pensioners in all sorts of guises. I'm surprised how many I know, but there again, I'm a Southwark pensioner, aren't I? So, and long may I continue to be a Southwark pensioner. I regard, and thank you very much to you, Dora, and thank you very much, Charlie. I regard giving this lecture as a very great honour. A very great honour. We know a lot, of course, about Tony. I mean, what a wonderful person. Fantastic campaigner. Fantastic researcher. Fantastic political activist. And a fantastic advisor to government ministers, who through his life has actually he improved social security. Not an easy thing to have achieved. A truly remarkable man. Now, I have to be honest and say I didn't know all that initially. When I first met him, because he was a great one for music, and I first met him because he taught all my daughters how to play the recorder. Now, I don't know whether he'd be disappointed or not with their subsequent performance with regards to music, but anyway, he was a great teacher and they enjoyed being taught by him. And it was wonderful to hear the music today as well. Okay, so this is the topic I'm going to talk on, reducing health inequalities. It's a pretty serious subject, and in a way I'd like to give a bit of a health warning, if that's the right phrase, because the first half of this talk is deeply depressing, deeply depressing. However, when we get to sort of halfway or thereabouts, we're suggesting some actions which hopefully can address some of the problems. So we have this call to action on the Vital Five. I should just mention that this is the front entrance of the London School of Economics. Probably quite a few people around here know the London School of Economics. Anyway, I went to the London School of Economics as a student in the 60s. Oh, not near enough to the phone. Not the phone, the microphone. Yeah, okay, I'll take it off, shall I? Yeah, and then you all accuse me of shouting. Or, anyway, perhaps you won't. Perhaps you won't. Okay, great. Well, can you hear me at the back now? Very good. Do you want me to start again, or did you get the general drift? Okay, you got the general drift. Well, look, this is the LSE where I was in the 60s, and Tony was there in the 60s. I have to be honest and say I didn't meet him. Maybe I passed him in the corridor, but I didn't know him personally at that time. But, of course, the LSE at that time was full of some great social scientists, unbelievable social scientists. And one of them was a guy called Richard Titmuss, who, most extraordinary man. And I had lectures from Richard Titmuss. And little did I know that down the corridor, Richard Titmuss was talking to Tony, and they were discussing how they were going to improve policy in relation to social security. So in a way, we sort of, our paths crossed at that point, except we didn't quite know it. So So when you think about how do you measure health, the ultimate measure really is life expectancy. And this slide shows life expectancy. And it's recent data. But it shows life expectancy in terms of how long people live relative to their levels of deprivation. So if you look at the right-hand side of this table, you will see that the top 10% in our society, they're often referred to as the least unprivileged. I think it's better to say that they are the most privileged. You see that they live, perhaps I better turn around this way, I can't quite see the screen from there. So the years, so 82, 83, 84 years. And as you go down the deciles, every 10% as you go down, it turns out people live less long. And when you get to the most deprived end of our society, it turns out that they live 8-9 years less. And that's an extraordinary state of affairs. It shows that we could all live to
the right-hand side of the graph, if we had the same opportunities, but actually we don't have those opportunities, so we're on the left-hand side of the graph. It's a deeply unfair situation. I don't know where you're all placing yourselves in this graph, but this is the fact of the matter, and it is an extraordinary demonstration of inequality in health. Now, the way we look at life expectancy, and people have looked at life expectancy for 150 years. This graph just shows the last 30 years. Every year, life expectancy increases. So on the vertical axis is weeks. So it normally goes up about a month, 2 months, 3 months, every year. So every 4 or 5 years, society gets an extra year of life. That has been going on, actually, for 70 years plus. And then you look, so you see it going up, that number of weeks every year, and then you look at the right-hand side of the graph. And what you see when you look at the right-hand side of the graph is since 2011-12, you see this reduction in the increase in life expectancy. This has not happened for decades, decades, and decades. In fact, there was a little blip when it did get reduced on the year that I was born. Okay, and I was born in 1944. And it turned out there was a world war on, which is not very good for life expectancy. But since that time, this has never happened, but it is happening now. So the increases in life expectancy are stalling. So that's food for thought for you. And food for thought for us all. If you look at this graph, and I hope you can see it, so this again goes back to our each 10% of society. So on the right-hand side of the slide are the most privileged, and on the left-hand side are the most disadvantaged. And these are the increases in life expectancy in weeks. So you can see that actually the people on the right-hand side continue to enjoy similar increases to the past in their life expectancy. But the people on the left of the graph are seeing smaller increases, and in fact, in the bottom third of our society, they are seeing reduced life expectancy. So the years are going by and they're living less long. For reasons that I'm not an expert on, this is particularly happening with women. So this is profound inequality, and it's clear that the inequalities in life expectancy are widening. An extraordinary state of affairs. Now, let's turn to our councils. So these are all the councils in London, and I've put the marker round the six of southeast London, and this is looking at life expectancy and the differences in life expectancy between the boroughs. And I don't think you'll be able to read the small print. But not surprisingly, the better off boroughs are at the top. You won't be surprised that the highest in London is Kensington and Chelsea, because it's that sort of place, although I tend to try to avoid it myself. But you'll see our local boroughs, so we're down at the bottom, I regret to say. So the difference is about 3 years are pretty low on this, and the difference is about 3 years in average life expectancy across the boroughs. So it's substantial, but it's not massive across southeast London. So that's between the boroughs. This is the difference in life expectancy within the boroughs. Within the boroughs. So these are the six boroughs of southeast London.
So if you take Southwark, and since we're in Southwark, we might as well talk about Southwark, what you can see is that life expectancy within this borough varies according to which centile you're in by almost 10 years. And I guess you recognise that when you're going around. When I've shown a similar slide to this before when I spoke to the Southwark pensioners, but there I divided this borough up into the wards. If you remember, Sally, the political wards. Well, the bottom line is that in Dulwich Village, they live 10 years longer than they do in Camberwell Green. So these very big differences across the borough. Some people in our society have a particularly serious challenge. So this data concerns the premature mortality of people with serious mental illness. And on the vertical axis is the excess deaths. This is excess under 75 mortality rates if you have severe mental illness. And your chances of dying are fourfold, 400% more if you have serious mental illness. Now, I guess you all know that, but it's still a very shocking example of health inequality. Now, we all agree that life expectancy is important. But of course, we also agree that the quality of your life, how well you are during your life, is very important. And that is referred to as healthy life expectancy. And if you look at this picture, which is similar to an early one, on the right-hand side are the most privileged in our society, the top 10%. And the total bar is life expectancy, but the lighter green is healthy life expectancy. So people in that top 10% live till they're 70, 71, before on average they get any significant health problem. And then they live a further 15 years or whatever it is, with impaired health, but it's a small percentage of their overall life expectancy. If, on the other hand, you go to the more deprived end of this graph, you see that, of course, the total life expectancy is less because we've already talked about that, but you'll see that the healthy life expectancy is much less. And people in the bottom 10% of our society run out of healthy life expectancy at the age of 52. And then they live for a big percentage of their total life, for the rest of their life, with ill health. So this again is a profound example of the inequalities across our society. And healthy life expectancy is really a major measure that we must focus on. It seems to me absolutely extraordinary, if we go back to Tony and the work he did. Here we have big chunks of our society running out of healthy life at the age of 52, when the pension age is whatever the pension age is. And if you haven't reached the pension age, what are you supposed to live on? Well, what you currently have to live on. So it is a profoundly unfair and difficult situation. This is healthy life expectancy. Is of healthy life expectancy in our boroughs. So again, if we take Southwark, which is on the right-hand side, you can see the difference in healthy life expectancy. So it's very substantial, about 8 years. And that's a big problem and a big challenge for Southwark. What's interesting is that the well-off boroughs, Bexley and Bromley, actually have a much wider gap when you look at healthy life expectancy. So although those boroughs overall are much better off, they have populations within those boroughs, at the bottom of the pile, so to speak, who have a very big problem in relation to reduced healthy life expectancy. So they have a tremendous amount of work to do, just as we do in Southwark. Now, you're aware that we've got the NHS long-term plan, and you will have read it and thought about it a bit, and there's been a lot of publicity, and you will either be underwhelmed or you'll think it's passable. But one thing it does focus on, it says that we have to demonstrate an improvement in healthy life expectancy, and we have to demonstrate a reduction of these health inequalities. So if you're running a CCG or, in Southwark, for example, you're going to be asked the examination question. What have you done in relation to inequalities or in relation to healthy life expectancy? What have you done to improve it? And it'll be interesting to see the results of that examination question as we go forwards. And on the right-hand side is the Chief Medical Officer's document, which is a rather good document, actually, but says much the same thing. The other problem we face in our society is that actually we are becoming more ill. I guess medicine has big advantages, but it does, of course, I'm all in favour of this, having spent my life in medicine. But it does keep people alive, which is fine. But it means that we do have a lot of people with long-term conditions. And I'm sure you've heard that phrase before. What this slide shows is that if you look at the present situation, the recent trends, and the projections going forward, the number of people with long-term conditions and multiple long-term conditions is going to increase and increase and increase. So it's about 11 million people at the moment, but it's going to rise by another 3 million people in the foreseeable future. So this is a huge challenge that the health and care system faces. Okay, so all that is deeply depressing. And I'm sorry to have depressed you. But now we have to look for glimmers of hope and plans to do better. So it turns out we know where most of these conditions come from, why they happen. The picture on the slide is the burden of disease. It's a detailed analysis of what causes people to die. And there are other aspects of what causes them to get ill. But so if you look at the burden of disease, you can get the burden of disease data for any country. You can get it for any city. You can get it for any borough. This is the burden of disease for Southwark, where we are sitting. And the most important cause of death in Southwark remains smoking. And the second greatest cause of death in Southwark is raised blood pressure. And the fourth highest is obesity. And of course, that drives in large measure the third highest, which is a raised glucose, diabetes. And the diabetes epidemic is clearly being driven by obesity. And then the next one down is alcohol. Deaths from alcohol. So the importance four on this slide are very, very important. Hence, they are four of the vital five. This slide shows not what kills you, but what causes disability. And the striking thing on this slide, this shows data from 1990 and 2017 and the change between those years. And you see that depression has increased very substantially and is now number three on the list. And you see that anxiety has risen also dramatically. So poor mental health is an increasing problem. And that is why we chose it as the fifth of the vital five. So it is clear that if we could crack or make progress with these five factors, we would have a dramatic effect on life expectancy, on healthy life expectancy, and on health inequalities, which is why we talk about the vital five. So let's, and we've got, I don't know whether you can read all this, but on this table is the vital five. So blood pressure, obesity, mental health, alcohol, smoking. In the middle, it talks about what that would do if we controlled it. Obviously, if you control hypertension, you stop vascular disease, so you stop heart attacks, you stop stroke, you reduce dementia, etc. So they all have a profound effect. And the far right of the slide makes the point that they're all very easy to measure. Very easy to measure. You can weigh people. You can measure their blood pressure. You can ask them how much they drink. You can ask them about their smoking. And you can also ask them about their mental health with very simple tables. And on the bottom is written, standardized routine recording and sharing of these five measures with patients, after all, it's their data, and professionals across primary, community, and secondary care will allow us to greatly improve and deliver consistent, high-quality care to all of our patients. So we've been making this case now for a couple of years, two or three years. And I'm very pleased to say that lots of people have been very receptive, including our healthcare commissioners. So I am delighted to be able to say that the Vital Five data are now being collected on all the patients in Guy's and St Thomas's and King's College hospitals. And this is a big step forward because, of course, thousands and thousands of patients flow through the hospitals. Now, I put this slide up because we all know that important as healthcare is, the real basic determinants are sort of before healthcare. It's whether you've had a good education, whether you've got a decent job, whether you've got a decent house to live in, and so on and so forth. And I fully accept that. All I would say to you, though, is that I don't think the signs are too good that these are being addressed with urgency. That's one of the understatements of the day, I should imagine. And health can make a difference. So this isn't a competition. We need to work synergistically, additively, but health can make a difference, and the Vital Five can make a difference. Smoking. Well, I'm pretty keen on, not on smoking, but I'm pretty keen on doing something about smoking, and I'm very pleased that Deborah Arnott, who directs ASH, is here today, and I've spent a lot of my life being involved with Action on Smoking and Health. So these are deaths caused by smoking in the United Kingdom and all the other European countries over the last 30 years. And actually, the UK has done best. It's a deeply impressive performance. It's still a big problem. It still sits at the top of the burden of disease. Have made a tremendous amount of progress. The problem with smoking is that it's very, very sort of class-related. It depends a lot on socioeconomic group. And that's what this slide shows. So smoking in so-called professional people, I don't know where you all put yourself, but anyway, managers, professional people, etc., is now pretty unusual. Whereas smoking in those who are more deprived and manual workers and so on and so forth, smoking remains much, much higher. So this is terribly important, because although we've made progress, we need to make progress with everybody, and we need to reach this group of people. And if we did so, of course, we will improve life expectancy, but we would greatly reduce inequalities. This is just pointing out the data in relation to severe mental health, because if you've got a severe mental health problem, smoking rates are enormously high. Enormously high. So in schizophrenia, 65% of patients smoke. And in bipolar, 37% smoke. And in depression and anxiety, 32% smoke. And those columns show the years of life lost in those groups as a result of smoking. So it's a huge problem in mental health. Great progress actually being made locally, I have to say, but it is a very, very big problem. Now, this is, I don't suppose you can see the detail of this, but this is the collection of smoking data. So this is a graph of what's happening at King's College Hospital on this slide, and actually Bromley Hospital, because King's now runs Bromley Hospital. And if you look at the bottom half of the slide, this is the percentage of patients flowing through the hospital who are asked about their smoking and given advice. And it's running along at about 80-85%. It took a while for Bromley to sort of pick up speed because it's been introduced relatively recently there. But this is it's a great graph, because it shows that we are asking all the people about smoking and we're making a lot of progress, and I'm very pleased with it. The other good news is that we, again, by courtesy, not courtesy, but working with our commissioners, we are now commissioning or introducing a much stronger program of helping people to stop smoking. And it's called the Ottawa model. If you've read the NHS long-term plan, you will know that it's referred to. And I'm pleased to say that we were influential in getting that into the long-term plan. So in the Ottawa model, obviously you identify the patients and you treat them properly in the hospital and give them a lot of support. But most importantly, you follow them up. You don't say goodbye to them. You follow them up for long periods after they have left hospital. And in Ottawa, what that did was show that you could double the quit rate. A lot of smokers are pretty ill, and they reduced the mortality at 2 years by half. And they reduced readmissions into the hospital, and the whole program was highly cost-effective. And I'm very pleased to say that this is now being commissioned for King's College Hospital and Guy's and St. Thomas's Hospital. So again, that's an enormous step forward, which will have an impact on us all here locally. Alcohol, deaths from alcohol. And again, you see exactly the same story, that if you look at the most deprived, which are the 20% of the population shown on the left of this slide, the death rate is very high and it gradually goes down until you reach the most privileged 20%. So alcohol, if we could make progress with alcohol, we would again reduce health inequalities. And we're doing a lot of work on alcohol, so this is a graph similar to the smoking one. We are talking to all the patients about their alcohol and who is drinking excessively. And we have a series of programs to which the patients can relate to. So we screen everybody, and we know that screening patients and talking about their alcohol, just doing that simple thing, reduces levels of drinking. And we have a team 7 days a week in the hospital to work with the patients who are very serious drinkers and offer support and make progress with them, and that also reduces
reduces alcohol and reduces admissions with a big return on investment because it stops the patients coming into the hospital. And we now have an alcohol assertive outreach team which follows the most difficult patients, the patients who are repeatedly coming into the hospital because they can't stop drinking excessively, to go out into the community and to work with and support these patients, the assertive outreach team. So all these things are happening, and I think that's very exciting. And some other people think it's exciting. So the assertive outreach team, this is them, led by Professor Colin Drummond in the middle from SLAM and the Institute of Psychiatry. And they won the Mental Health Team of the Year Award from the BMJ this year. So other people are noticing that we're doing lots of exciting work in this area. Obesity. I guess this is the toughest nut to crack. I mean, this is a real, real problem. It is causing the diabetes epidemic, and it is of profound importance. This slide actually shows data from children, not from adults, from children. And it illustrates the growing inequalities in relation to obesity in children. So if you just take the top graph, the top line, these are the most deprived. And the graph goes from 2006-07 to 10 years later. And you can see that the most deprived, the levels of obesity, which were 23% obesity, 10 years ago, have now reached almost 30%. If you look at the comparable line, so those are boys, and then if you look at the dashed line, which is the higher of the dashed lines, which is also boys, but these are the least deprived in our society, then of course it's a problem, but it's much less of a problem, and actually it's been held steady over the last 10 years. So the most deprived have figured out a way of doing rather better, or they're enabled to do a bit better, a lot better, supported to do a lot better. But the result is, of course, that the gap has widened between the children from disadvantaged backgrounds to those from privileged backgrounds, and is now absolutely huge in obesity, 15. So it's extraordinary, 15%. So, and of course, obesity in children is so important because it very, very commonly results in obesity in adults. I was very pleased to see this report. This is a report from the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health in a very recent report saying, well, look, we've got to get a grip of this. So we should weigh children. I know it's revolutionary. But we've got to weigh children. And we've got to weigh them at 2, which we do at the moment. But then normally we don't weigh them again for a while. But we're going to weigh them every year till they're 18. And then, of course, you can see the children crossing the centile lines. Not to get heavy about it, to have a conversation and to see what more support you can give people who are on the wrong trajectory. So I'm very, very pleased by that report. So this is just a general statement on obesity. So obesity has increased threefold, and that's across the world. Threefold in the last 40 years. So are obese. Adults on this planet are obese. I strongly believe this next statement, and it's very important. Obesity should be addressed like any other chronic condition, because that's what it is. With understanding, with support and treatment, and without stigma. And that's a very important piece of the sentence. And I think that the hope for anybody who finds themselves with this chronic disease is that even modest weight loss, 5 to 10%, improves significantly control of blood sugar,
so it can stop the development of type 2 diabetes or improve existing diabetes. It reduces blood pressure. It reduces cholesterol. It increases mobility, quality of life, and it reduces depression. So even modest changes can have very big impact. And we need to remember that. And we need to encourage and support and not get into stigma. Mental health. So I've already referred to it, but this slide makes the point that it's very, very common. And we are measuring mental health across the hospital. People come in, so when I go to my orthopedic clinic, I'm given an iPad and there's questions on it, and I answer the mental health questions and so on and so forth, and they get recorded. Because depression is a very common condition in patients with physical illness. So 23% in the rheumatology population have depression. And anxiety is similarly common. For example, 21% in the orthopedic population. So these are very, very common. And if you, but what's interesting is when you look at the notes of these patients and you look at all the referral letters over the months and the years, no one mentions these things. And when you look at the consultant's notes back to the people who've referred the patients, there's never any mention of mental health. So it's news, except to the patient, of course. And whereas if you really understand that the patient in front of you has got a degree of a mental health problem, it totally alters the way that you seek to support and help that patient with these common conditions. So we are doing this at scale now and at increasing scale across the hospital. And of course, if people, the data shows that they are above a certain threshold, we can then, of course, refer to our colleagues in psychiatry and psychology. This graph just gives some fairly recent data. So we've looked at 75,000 patients screened in this way. This process is now in 58 clinics across Guy's and Thomas's and across King's. Now, blood pressure. So we're getting near the end here, but blood pressure. I told you that it was number two on the burden of disease in Southwark, killing thousands of people. So, who knows their blood pressure? Don't be shy. Well, I'm deeply depressed. I am deeply depressed because only a minority put their hands up. And the thing is, there's no symptoms with blood pressure. Everybody should know their blood pressure. As it turns out, and the black community, important as they are, very important in Southwark, is slightly underrepresented in this audience, but in the black community, blood pressure is a very big problem because the black African population has genetics that makes blood pressure. So but you can walk around at the age of 35, 40, 45, 50 with raised blood pressure and not know you've got it until you have a stroke or you get heart failure. Or your kidneys pack in. You should all know your blood pressure. I know my blood pressure. I've got raised blood pressure. I hope it's not raised at the moment, but I'm on treatment. I'm on treatment. And it's fine. Monday. You should know your blood pressure. So Monday, today's Wednesday, isn't it? You've got to get on the phone tomorrow and you've got to say to your GP, look, I want to come and see you because I must have my blood pressure measured. It's easy peasy, of course, to get a machine to do it from the chemist. But anyway, you need to get your blood pressure measured. Now, one of the great problems with blood pressure, because it doesn't have symptoms, it's a real problem. So in Lambeth, they've got a very, very good data system called Lambeth DataNet. And it takes all the health data from all the general practices on every patient over years. This is anonymized data. No one knows where the data comes from in terms of individual patients, and it is not used to help the management of individual patients, but it's used for research. And they recently published a paper, very recently this year, in the Journal of Hypertension. And in broad terms, what that showed was that blood pressure is unbelievably common. So 20% of the adult population has got raised blood pressure. Extraordinary. So in Lambeth, that's 60,000 people. Be very similar in Southwark. 60,000 people. And half of them were not known to general practice. Extraordinary. And 50% who were known to general practice, 50% were controlled, but 50% weren't. So the conclusion you're forced to come to is that 45,000 people, in other words, three quarters of those with raised blood pressure, 45,000 people are either not identified or they're not properly treated. And yet that is despite the fact that drugs to treat hypertension are readily available, they're very effective, they're very safe, and they're dirt cheap because they've been off patent for years. And as I said, I've got raised blood pressure, I've been taking these tablets, it's absolutely bloody fine. So there's no excuse, but the challenge is reaching the people and getting the people to realise that they must know their blood pressure. Now, as it turns out, Southwark are pulling their finger out now. I mean, perhaps they've been galvanised by Lambeth's example. But anyway, so there is a wonderful programme called Clinical Effectiveness Southwark, and I'm pleased to say that one of the leaders of that programme is in the audience. And they have now started working really hard across primary care in Southwark to really get the message about blood pressure and make sure that every opportunity is taken in primary care to measure blood pressure and to control it effectively. And if they did that, of course, they would stop people getting heart disease, they would stop heart failure in a lot of patients, they would stop a lot of strokes, and they'd save a lot of lives. So, and they know that. So they're really entering into the spirit of things, and I'm very pleased with the program. So, I've covered the vital five. Just to finally say that as we've thought about this, we really have a vision of the vital five for life. So, I've talked mainly about the adult vital five, but we're talking a lot with our paediatricians. So, what would they choose as being vital things to do? Now, as it turns out, obesity is on their shortlist. They're also very interested in parental smoking, because children in households where no one smokes are pretty unlikely to take up smoking. Whereas if your mother smokes, you will take it up, and if your father smokes, then you've got further magnification of that. So really, smoking is virtually an inherited disease at the moment. So they're interested in that. And then at the other end of this slide, older people, the older people are very interested in frailty. And so we're doing a lot of work on frailty. I have to say, just in passing, that I went to the Falls class down in Peckham's, the old folks in Camberwell Green. I felt, Sally, that a lot of the people there receiving help there, they'd gone too far. So what we need to do is identify frailty much, much sooner. Much, much sooner. Anyway, the geriatricians are onto it. We're doing a lot of work on learning disabilities to help. I've mentioned mental health. So we're implementing a system-wide approach to improve the vital five for a population. We're having a population-wide conversation about this, because you can't impose things, but to make sure that we develop the correct approach. We're enabling primary, community, and secondary care to share and update Vital 5 scorecards. So in a future world, you'll go into your general practice, they will have your Vital 5 scorecard. When they refer you to the hospital for something, the Vital 5 scorecard will be transferred. The hospital will have a Vital 5 scorecard. You will have the Vital 5 scorecard. If you're me, like me, you'll take your blood pressure at home and then you'll put the latest record on your Vital 5 scorecard and it'll be shared across the system. And then it'll say John Moxham's wonderful because he checks his blood pressure a lot and it's perfectly controlled. Or something like that. Whether he'll say the same about alcohol, we'll have to see. Okay, because we need to support people to know and improve their Vital 5 even when they are well. So that is the clarion call. But to do this, we've got to all talk with each other. We've got to work together. This can't just be done in a hospital. We've had lots of discussions with local people. Actually, local people think this is a great idea. All the patient groups think it's wonderful. You need to talk to the commissioners because they've got the money that commission services, and we've done a lot of that. We've talked a lot in primary care, so we're working very closely together. The local authorities and public health are involved, and they're very keen as well. And we've also talked a lot about it inside King's Health Partners and the staff. We're going to do a staff Vital 5. The hospitals employ huge numbers of people. Why wouldn't we be interested in their Vital 5? We want healthy staff. Although, to be honest, I think the greatest side effect of that will be that they will be great proponents of the Vital 5 and in dealing with the patients. Because at the end of the day, patients come first. So, I've finished. I thought there was a comment on there, but thank you.
Have a seat. Well, I told you so, didn't I? Absolutely inspirational. Thank you so much, Professor Moxham. That was amazing. I forgot to say earlier on that I served on the Southwark Health and Wellbeing Board with Professor Moxham for a few years, and it was one of those typical council meetings, they'd go on and on, 2-3 hours, chat. And then Professor Moxham would come in right at the end and say something, just cut right through everything people have said before and make a lot of sense. So you've done so today as well. Thank you very much indeed. Before I open up to questions, being chair, I've got a bit of an advantage here. So I just want to ask you a couple of questions first, if that's okay. No disrespect, but I mean, the Vital 5, I suppose most of us in this room, if we were asked what we think the Vital 5 are, we would come up with obesity, high blood pressure, I mean, smoking. I mean, it's common sense. But why is it we don't actually, you know, take care of our, you know, these Vital 5s? Why don't we do something about it? I mean, is it stigma? You mentioned up on the slide there could be education, it could be, you know, mental health issues and stress because we haven't got the right housing or something like that. I don't know, but we know what they are. So why aren't we doing something about it ourselves and taking ownership of it?
Yeah, but I do think that when you delve deeply into all this, you've sort of got to be to have quite a lot of control over your... You've got to have quite a lot of control over your own lives. It's very difficult, for example, to resist taking up smoking if you're in a community where all your chums smoke. Smoking is an addiction. It's not really a choice. Well, it may be a choice at the very beginning, and you want to copy your peer group. But it rapidly becomes a very, very powerful addiction. But whether you take it up. I used to smoke. That's why I took it up. Well, in all fairness, my grandmother used to do roll-ups and give them to me when I was 8. But anyway, moving on from that. But there are counters to that. So if you are in a family where no one smokes, I mean, if you go to a dinner party or a big gathering at Dulwich Village, none of the buggers smoke, right? So say you're a child in that environment and you lit up, everybody would say, my God. And a lot of the children would say, my God, what is it? Do you know John Dan, he smokes, unbelievable. So I think you've got to be empowered to do that. Now let's take obesity. It's actually quite tough and quite expensive to eat really, really well. I mean, I'm in the sort of slightly Ponzi class as well, because we have, you're not going to believe this, but so I've gone from, in my youth, having baked beans on toast about five times a week and all the rest of it, and all that stuff, fish fingers and everything, and loads of sugar on things and loads of salt. We now have a box delivered from some organic place. Actually, they're so good that I'll advertise on Riverford, right? So they come round and it's all perfect stuff. But if you're trying to bring up a family on an inadequate income, the price is absolutely critical. When I come back from the hospital and I go down the main road, sometimes when I've been at Guy's up the Walworth Road, or if I'm down in Camberwell, there's a queue after school for the Kentucky Fried Chicken and all the rest of it. But it's as cheap as chips. I'm, sorry to play on it. And you get on the bus and they're all eating their supper. And, so you've got to be empowered to do these things. And I think it's... I appreciate it's easy to say, but these aren't, at the end of the day, choices that people just rationally make. And similarly, if you're a child like this and you get overweight, you've got a really uphill struggle to deal with this problem. So I'm not so keen on, but we have to do much, much better in supporting the whole population to do the right thing, rather than say they've got to do it of their own accord, in my judgment.
Do we have any questions? Anybody want to ask any questions? Oh, lots of hands. Oh, my gosh. You might be here all week, Professor Mox. You don't mind, do you?
No, I don't mind. No. Okay. Well, 10 minutes up the road. You can stay as long as you like.
Okay. Well, let's start at the front and work our way down. Yes, that's lovely. Okay, fantastic. There's the lady in the blue just here. Should we just do this side? Then there's Steve, Lancashire, just in the red there. Anybody else on this side? And then there's a lady in yellow and black over there. So the lady in the blue, off you go.
Thank you. Hello, John. Hello. It's lovely to hear you speak. I don't want to ask about smoking. You'll be surprised to hear. What I want to ask about is the Vital Five, because you say Guy's and St. Thomas's and King's are going to be making sure they use it. But what about doctors in primary care? What about community care? Is it going to be throughout the healthcare system? Yeah. Because most people see their GPs rather than go to hospital.
No, and maybe I didn't make that clear enough, but the answer is yes. It's going to be across primary care as well. So the dashboard will be shared and filled in wherever the patients are. And we have a lot of support from general practice. Isn't that... Rashna as a GP, and we've spoken a lot with GPs, and I would like to think that we've not been at all old school. It's not a question of superior, in quotes, question mark, people going out to general practice. It's not been like that at all. We've had very balanced discussions about this with primary care. I presented a lot at primary care meetings, and primary care is totally on board with this. Now, the commissioners are very important because private people in primary care, have to be paid for what they do. So it's so important that we have all the commissioners of all the services on board with this. But I'd just like to say that when we were talking about this, I don't know when it was, Jill, two years ago or 2.5 years ago, in a meeting that you were at, and we were talking about the Vital Five, and we were talking specifically about blood pressure at that meeting. The local commissioner, the lead commissioner for South East London, became very interested in it, and she has been interested ever since, and is doing all she can, in my judgment, to find a bit of extra money to drive this along. Now, it's tough, of course, because the money, after all, we spend less per head on health than most countries in Europe. So clearly, money is unbelievably tight. But within those constraints, I think that they are trying very hard, the commissioners, to help. And they're highly intelligent, and they realise that if we did this and made people healthier, we would actually turn off the tap into the services. It's a very big win if one can make the initial investment.
Thank you. Steve
Lancashire,
sorry.
Steve. Thanks, Dora. a bit greedy. Two quick questions. One is, I want to focus on the first depressing half of your lecture, John, and about the inequalities.
Yeah.
Great research, but wanted to, apart from genetics, wanted to hear from you about the why of those inequalities, if you could say a bit about that.
Yeah.
And secondly, as you'll be aware, in the South East London, I expect that's why some of those slides referred to South East London, there is in process a plan to merge the six CCGs, the six borough CCGs. What impact do you think that will have on all these health inequalities and the needs of people in Southwark?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, I'll give you my view. I'm not saying I'm right. Seriously, I'm not saying I'm right. But the fact is, crummy societies and crummy governments produce unequal bad societies and communities, which produces unequal health. It's actually a political decision of the people and the people they empower to run governments to spend the money the way they spend it. And we do much less well than many countries in Europe now. But if you look at those countries, they are spending more on the sort of things that matter, and they have much lower levels of inequalities across their society. So these inequalities are driven by the decisions made by all of us, but including the people who lead us at the very top, is my judgment. So if you... Now, I mean, I'm pretty passionate about this subject, and I know a bit about it because, you know... But there are some people whose job it is to know about this even deeper than me. And one of the people I admire in the system at the moment, and a senior academic, is Marmot. And his drop is that it's probably, this catastrophic drop is related to austerity. Now, you know, it's a difficult thing to prove. Although, if you go back in time, and Joseph will correct me on the dates, but when the Labour government... Now, look, I'm not getting too party political about this, but when the Labour government came in post-Thatcher, they did have reducing inequalities in all policies, in health, but in housing, and in education, and all the rest of it. And then time passed, and some people might say they ran out of steam a bit, and then other stuff happened. But if you look at the impact on inequalities, inequalities did narrow during that period. So they were very wide, they narrowed, and then they become wider again, and now they are terribly wide. Now, you know, we could argue, it's the sort of thing we could spend a very long session in the pub on this, but that's my answer to your first bit of the question, that you need decent governments, and you need to pay taxes. What was the second one? The second bit of your question was, what was your second? Oh, yeah. Well, to be honest, I've been in the game a long time, as you can see from my decrepitude. When people ask me who I work for when I was a junior doctor, this will shock you, this. I said I work for the NHS. Extraordinary. And when some bright spark came up with this idea of having trusts, I was already a consultant at King's, I said, etch this on your soul at the consultants' meeting. Didn't make any difference, of course, and we became a trust. And then, damn me, they invent foundation trusts where we're all supposed to compete. And meanwhile, some joker invents something called payment by results, which sucks people into the hospital. So then the whole pie of the money for healthcare, the slices change size. So we have a much smaller slice for mental health, because that isn't underpayment by results, and a much smaller slice for primary care, and the hospitals gobble up the biggest slice. It is no way to run a railway. I think, if I answered the question?
I think you have, fantastically.
Thank you very much for having this lecture. This is my first attendance at this lecture, and I'm very pleased that you're dealing with issues which concern me on a daily basis.
Yeah.
When I retired from employment, I was very pleased that my surgery asked me to come in for an examination of my blood pressure.
Yeah.
It was surprising because throughout my working life, it's always been 60 over 120, or rather 120 over 60.
Yeah.
You know, and I was surprised that they were concerned. I was surprised that my doctor was concerned that there was a slight variation upwards
from
the 60, which they regarded as the, you know, really crucial one. On that basis, I was put on high blood pressure tablets.
Uh-huh.
It was shocking then. But now, when I go to my surgery, the doctors don't really, like having to devote some time to take your blood pressure. Okay. They say, oh, you should have a meter at home, and I can hardly use it anyway.
Yeah.
You see? And when they do actually, decide to check your blood pressure as, a required consider. I'm surprised they don't even consider is it 140 over 94 as something serious. They just say, don't worry, it's 94, you should be all right. I thought 94 should be, a major cause for concern. And they don't do anything about it.
Yeah, okay.
So going to the surgery now for my blood pressure seems to me a complete waste of time. So, why are they not under pressure to do a good job on their patients?
I don't know whether I can answer that in a specific way. Blood pressure does go up a bit with age, and you do have to make a judgment whether you should treat. Now, there is guidance from NICE, National Institute of Clinical Excellence. But, of course, it's not just about drugs. So if the blood pressure's up just a little bit,
I'm not saying this applies to you, but drinking less, stopping smoking, exercise, losing weight, all reduce blood pressure. And whereas the drugs, although they are well tolerated in large measure, they still need you to take drugs, and no drugs are totally devoid of problems. So there's a balance to be struck, is all I would say, I think. I mean, you need to have a chat with your GP about it. But I would emphasise, and I think I covered it in an earlier remark, that people should see their GP more, not less. They should see their GPs all the bloody time, right? hang on. Because they are the bedrock of good care. But the trouble is that their slice of the cake has been dramatically reduced. So they have, I don't know, 8 minutes to see me or something, and I've got 83 problems, and I walk in, and they say, why have you come? And I start talking, and they say, that's it then, off you go. So, but they have to, because there's a load of people outside. So we need a change in the way we structure things. I haven't answered the previous question, though, have I?
Should we come back to this in a second? I need to get three, because I'm looking for time as well. I'll take three from this side. There's a lady here. The gentleman next to you here as well. One, two, and three. Yeah.
I mean, if it helps, I'm not leaving quickly. So, and I think we've booked a room over in the pub, actually. But anyway, so don't feel too constrained.
Hello. I would like to ask you about accessibility of information.
Yes.
I'm partially sighted, and many of my family members are. And you talk about taking your own blood pressure and reading information.
Yeah.
But
information
is not accessible.
Sure.
I took my stepdad to a diabetes workshop, and I asked the nurse if she could provide information in different formats.
Yeah.
The look on her face was quite something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the workshop itself was not flexible to include somebody who could not see.
Yeah.
So disability and health inequality, I think, is equally just as important as these other topics that you brought up.
Yeah, yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. I could not agree with you more. People with various disabilities have been very harshly treated by the system, including learning disabilities. It is outrageous. And we are, I didn't talk about it, but I promise you, we've got a whole group looking at this. We're going to make a difference. I promise you. I had the privilege or misfortune, whichever way you like to look at it, on sitting on a major report on the healthcare of people with learning disabilities about 10 years ago. And I even now, it makes me break out into a cold sweat, because there were a load of people with learning disabilities and their families in one committee, and then there was us, the experts, and we promised these people we would make a difference. And we wrote this bloody report. Sir Jonathan Michael and chaired it, and I was part of that, and I said we would fix it, but it just joined another lot of reports on the floor as they stack up the reports. But we are working it, and we will do better, and what you say is absolutely right.
Yeah, my question is basically, you talked about Dulwich and Camberwell, and I think the self-evident thing about Dulwich and Camberwell is that the people in Dulwich are very comfortable. They've got their own house and everything else. There is not the opportunity for good housing in Camberwell, and I think this has a terrible effect on health outcomes. I wonder if you'd like to speak to that, please.
Yeah, well, I tried to cover it in one slide, where I pointed out that the basic determinants of health are very, very important, but we in health can only do what we in health can do. But you're absolutely right that your education, your life chances, your employment, the money you earn, the house you've got,
the environment that you're in is all absolutely spot on. In fact, the short answer to this problem is simply to say, if we all lived the way the rich do, we wouldn't have a problem. It just turns out difficult to arrange and organise, and the rich will not give up the money. So, well, I mean, actually, that's a political statement, isn't it? I'm sorry about that.
No,
But that's why I made my comment about it's important to move to a country. Well, actually, I'm not moving anywhere. I'm staying in Camberwell. But, you know, if in a different world, I would move to a high-tax state because you want to pay lots of taxes and have lots of what you discussed, you know, decent housing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, across the whole. But, you know, we are where we are. Anyway, you can think about that a bit and you can think what you think when we come up to December the 14th, can't you? And December the 12th. Oh, sorry.
Hello. Okay, my name's Gloria Brown and I actually live in Camberwell. And you say that there are five things, the five vitals. You haven't mentioned drugs.
Yeah.
Drugs is a killer in this area.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, this area, I live in Camberwell.
So
and
do
there's
I.
There's a vast number of people coming through, but it's actually quite depressing.
Yes.
During the day, you see lots of people that are actually struggling.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you say anxiety and depression.
Yeah.
It just, it's quite sad
it
that
is.
People are struggling. And, you know, no disrespect to you, and I found your lecture excellent. I wish I had a teacher like you, because you put over a very complicated subject, and it was so easy. I didn't have to say, what does that word mean?
Okay.
But I just think it's really important that you actually bring back, people are struggling, they're having a terrible time, very worried, benefits, and now Brexit,
you know.
God help us.
Thank you. That was a good question. A lot of us here were probably children in the 1950s, where the air quality was horrible. We all remember the yellow smogs and fogs, and in various Clean Air Acts got rid of that. The smokeless coal came in and central heating. So the air that we breathed improved. Now that seems to have come back as part top of the agenda, the air that we breathe. And I just wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Perhaps I'll ask the KHP team to remember what the questions were.
Should we just ask the lady there?
Me? Yes, thank you. Good afternoon, Professor Moxon. Thank you so much. We first met on the sponsor board of Southwark and Lambeth Integrated Care. And there I gained a reputation for repeating and asking workforce, the paid workforce, the unpaid workforce. When would that topic be systematically put on the agenda of every CCG board meeting, health and wellbeing board meeting, and other board meeting, so that we could compare the reality of our workforce situation, be we paid or unpaid, and the plans and the money, and repeatedly, why are we not that request is refused? Why are we not exposing the reality behind not being able to have more than 8 or 10 minutes with our GP? Please, can we get that kind of information out there for Southwark, for Lambeth, for all of us? Mm-hmm. That's my request to you and my plea. Thank you.
Okay. So we started off with drugs. It's an unbelievably serious issue. King's Health Partners, which I'm part of, is very one of our clinical academic groups is focused on drugs, and it's largely based in the hospital across the road. There are world-leading academics trying to do something about that. But it is a very, very, very difficult problem with many different dimensions. So, for example, they did a study across the road on heroin users. And instead of the normal business with heroin users, getting the stuff off the street and all that sort of stuff, lots of deaths from overdoses and also people having to rob people to get the money to buy the drugs, you came along to the hospital and you were given clean heroin in the right dose and you injected it. And then you came back the next day. Okay? And they did a clinical, we did a big clinical study on this called the Riot Study. I don't know why it's called the Riot, it sounds. Anyway, but it was. And it got national and international profile. But the government of this country would not take it any further forward. It was a very cost-effective approach because you're not only for the patient, that is the drug user, it's clean so you don't get all the complications, but it also saves a shed load of money to society because you don't have, you not, don't get antisocial behaviour and so on and so forth. That approach has been taken up by several European governments, but not ours. Not ours. The second thing about drugs, the only country that's doing spectacularly worse for us than us in terms of life expectancy is the United States. So life expectancy in the United States is falling down a steep slope. And the reason it's falling down a steep slope are drugs. So there are literally hundreds of thousands, millions of people who are addicted to heroin, morphine, and related drugs in the United States. And, I mean, it makes you want to weep. But this is mainly this is in communities that have lost all hope. They're facing second-generation unemployment and a lot of other crummy, you know, really depressed areas. And to be honest, not only is the United States doing very little about it, the medical profession is corrupt. So that the companies, this is the Sackler family, of course they sponsor every art gallery you can go into because you have to, you know, massage your image. They gave big bonuses to doctors for prescribing these drugs. Now, we're just seeing that starting here, not because of the corruption of the doctors, but we have to really focus very carefully in this country that the same thing doesn't happen. Because, of course, when you get addicted to these drugs, that then you find out that, you know, they're not quite powerful enough, and then you're on the street again, and you can imagine what goes on. So I've not really answered your question, except that I totally empathise with your question, but we wanted to just choose the things that stood at the very top of the burden of disease. But I entirely take your point, and we're sort of on the case, but I feel for you. Pollution. Well, pollution, God. I remember it. You couldn't see the... When I was at the LSE, you crossing Waterloo Bridge, you couldn't see the other end of it. Light, and in the night time, you just see these yellow lights. You thought, I must vaguely be on the path, because it's... But it absolutely terrible. And then it did get a lot better, I agree. But, of course, in that time... Just imagine the other changes that have taken place. So, for example, the use of cars has increased unbelievably. And so cars use, you know, burn petrol and all that. So we have all the problems that we've got with pollution, but we have a world expert at King's on pollution, and he came actually to locally to give a lecture recently. But then he depressed me totally, because it turns out the tyres are a problem. Right? The particles from the tyres. It turns out the brakes are a problem. It turns out even the roads are a problem because there's plastic in them. So, I mean, we got a long way to go on that. And, I mean, long live all the campaigners that are trying to do something about it. We've got to totally change the way we run our society and fix that. I mean, you know, for reasons, totally different reasons, because she's a bit of a coward. My wife won't fly. But actually, you know, sorry, I shouldn't say things like that, sure, Nikki. But she's very sensitive, you know, just because the plane filled up with smoke and had to turn round, she got agitated. Anyway, but we've got to change the way we live our lives in terms of the... But I tell you, I'm really anxious about the tyres and the brakes and all the rest of it. So it's a hell of a problem. And also, across the road in the neuro departments, they're showing changes in children's brains. Right? Related to the pollution. And we've got loads of primary schools that are on main roads. You couldn't make it up. People in Dulwich Way wouldn't allow that sort of thing. My God. They wouldn't live in such a place, would they? No. Because they can choose. They're empowered. But we've given them the power, you know. So, all right. Well, what was the third one?
Hello? Excuse me. I think it's my turn. Please.
Oh, yes. So we were talking about workforce. We were talking about workforce, yeah. Well, I totally agree with you. It's a big issue. All I would say is, now, I did say that I was interested in the Vital Five in the workforce, and we're going to do the Vital Five for the workforce. But we're interested in our workforce in a much bigger dimension than that. I'm now talking about King's Health Partners, the hospitals, and I'm talking about the university, King's College London. And we have a lot of work going on because we know we need to attract and retain and look after our workforce. So it's a big program at the moment, which we agree that we've been a bit slow out of the blocks on. But certainly as far as King's Health Partners is concerned, we are deeply committed to that. And King's, KCL, King's College London, is now branding itself, as you know, as a civic university. And it is determined to engage with its population and people and bring the strength of the university to better support the people. So, I know, I mean, you know, we're both grey. Well, actually, I'm a bit beyond grey, but, you know, I know we've been at this a very long time, but, you know, yeah.
Okay, thank you. So we have one more question. It's a lady there.
Actually, okay. Sorry, I've declined to ask the question. I will ask you personally, one-to-one.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, thank you. Great stuff. So before I ask you all to thank Professor Moxham, I just want to say that today's a very, very special day for him. And to explain more, don't say it like that. I'm going to invite Jill Lockett to come to the stage and just say a few words about why it's Professor Moxham's very, very, very special day today.
Thank you, everybody. And I've been asked to slightly embarrass John and give a vote of thanks. I just want to say thank you to Sally and the Lyons family for the privilege, I think, for King's Health Partners to be here today. Absolute treat. And it's an absolute treat to be in this absolutely stunning building, isn't it? And it's very lovely. John often swears quite a lot in his presentations, and I think he only swore 3 times in the presentation today. So I think that's also very well done, John. Very well done. I thought you weren't going to swear at all, so I think you did quite well on the 3. Tomorrow is John's last day at work. John, I know. So after 46 years of service, world-class international researcher, outstanding respiratory physician, brilliant teacher, and a brilliant colleague, John, absolutely brilliant colleague. He's demonstrated today to you that he's just got the most phenomenal intellect, a strong sense of public health and community. He's a good Camberwellian. But he's also got a very good sense of humour, hasn't he? And I think when you bring those three things together, it's something very special. At the beginning of today, we talked about this house has belief in action. The presentation earlier, this house has a belief in action. And I think John's message to us all is about action. It is about purpose. Some of it's about protest. I'm not getting party political at all, but it is about protest. And it is about increasing value and reducing inequality and giving a better deal to our residents and our patients and delivering that through our health services and through the research we lead and provide. So with that, I think we should say thank you for the 46 years of Moxham. Thank you very much, John.
And we also have a presentation for you from Hannah. Hannah?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
And Charlie?
I'd like to present John with the Southwark Pensioners book, even though I've worked out now I've only got 53 months to go.
Shame. Never mind. Congratulations, Professor Moxham.
Thank you very much.
Well done. Hooray. Well done. Thank you, Southwark. We now have a brief interlude with the choir.